When actors Corey Lee Smith and Elise Sharp started their own Shakespeare podcast, Shakespeare Anyone, they wanted to do deep dives into the history, themes, and scholarly analysis of all of Shakespeare's plays without, as Corey says, going into the crippling debt of grad school. And they did just that. Their series on Macbeth alone has 10 episodes with a total of 7 hours of Macbeth content. They're now moving on to Twelfth Night, and from the looks of things, they'll be devoting the same amount of time there. Today, Corey and Elise join us to discuss one of the major aspects of Macbeth they discuss, the history behind King James's obsession with witchcraft and how it feeds into the play. We'll be discussing Shakespeare's historical sources for the play, what the political climate was like in England at the time, how England's king became so obsessed with witches and the supernatural, and what Shakespeare's goal might have been in writing a play steeped in treason and sorcery. So get ready for a spooky time, and without further ado, here are Corey and Elise. Hi, Corey and Elise, it's so great to have you here.
Hi, Emily, thanks for having us.
Yeah. Hi, Emily.
So tell me about your podcast, Shakespeare Anyone. How did you guys meet and how do you guys start your podcast?
Yeah. I'll start out because I'm the one who had the idea. Elise and I met when we were working on a touring play together. And so we were, you know, hitting the road in the van. I knew that Elise was a Shakespeare actor and was a Shakespeare scholar. And I was really fascinated by all the things that she had to say when I'd hear her talk about Shakespeare. And that stuck in my mind. And then during the pandemic, I was like, I really need something to do because I can't act. I can't do much of anything right now. And I really wanted to make a podcast because I love podcasts. And so I reached out to Elise after a failed attempt with some other people and was like, hey, Elise, I would like to start a podcast, a Shakespeare one. And Elise was like, I love the idea. Hold on. I just started work. So give me a month. And then and then I checked in a month later and was like, hey, do you still want to do a podcast? And she was like, yeah. And so then we met up, talked about how to make a Shakespeare podcast, what our goals were, and it started there.
That's fantastic. And when you introduce your podcast, you say that you're trying to make a Shakespeare podcast without the bardolatry. Can you tell us what that means?
Yeah. So my idea was to get into the heavier parts of Shakespeare that we don't really talk about in English classes or drama classes. Yeah. And the term bardolatry came about when I was writing one of the intro scripts, the intro series scripts, and I wrote that word bardolatry. And I think Elise pinned that as like, that's something that we should put in as our advertising, is that we're doing a Shakespeare podcast minus the bardolatry, because, you know, Shakespeare comes with all of this baggage when it comes to the elitism and Shakespeare's
the pedestal that he's put on in our culture.
Yeah. And so that word, first of all, it's a great word. Bardolatry is a fantastic word. And second of all, it really gets to the heart of what we're trying to do, which my goal when I brought this to Elise was, let's make this approachable. Let's make this fun. And let's take this out of the realm of you have to be, you know, this big academic to understand what's happening in these plays.
Yeah, and sounds like you succeeded in it, because you take some really serious academic concepts and make it very accessible. So good for you guys. So I've listened to your Macbeth series, which goes into such incredible detail. Obviously, we won't come close to getting all of it in. But basically, what we're here to talk about is Macbeth, King James, and witchcraft. So King James, how long had he been king when Shakespeare was writing Macbeth?
2 or 3 years?
Not that long, right?
Not that long. Yeah, he ascended to the throne in 1603. And then Macbeth, the gunpowder plot. Yeah, go ahead, Elise. Yeah,
Macbeth is usually dated around 1606. We don't have an exact date because nobody
of course
was,
not.
You know, Shakespeare wasn't writing to publish. But most scholars place it around 1606 because the gunpowder plot occurred in November of 1605, and there are lots of references to testimony that was given during the trials that followed the gunpowder plot and right. the things that were said by the conspirators that appear in Macbeth almost word for word. So it must yeah. be after that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. And for listeners who might not know, although it's pretty well known, what was the gunpowder plot?
The gunpowder plot was the biggest and most infamous assassination attempt on King James. And there were some attempts beforehand, but this one was the big one. And it was an attempt by a small group of disgruntled Catholic English subjects to blow up Parliament and assassinate King James. And then the goal was to get his daughter, Elizabeth, to the throne. I want to say kind of in a puppet way, because the Catholics mm-hmm. were very upset with how James, a Protestant king, was handling a lot of the religious tensions that were going on at that time. So this was a small group of Catholics who conspired to blow up Parliament, and they got found out because there was an anonymous letter that was sent to Monteagle. His name is William Parker, 4th Baron Monteagle, and Guy Fawkes and all the conspirators got found out and executed.
Yeah, yeah. That's rough. And it's interesting you talked about the references that show up in Macbeth, and one of those is, I believe you talked about the dunnest smoke of hell. That line mm-hmm. is kind of stems from the gunpowder plot. What are other things in Macbeth that, you know, relate to the gunpowder plot?
A big one is the porter's speech. The porter references an equivocator as one of the three characters that the porter welcomes into hell when he's pretending to be the port at Hell's Gate. And Father Henry Garnett, who was a Catholic priest at this time, wrote this paper on equivocation, and his whole thing was the big E word, equivocation, which we see throughout Macbeth as well, right?
Yeah.
And he was convicted in association with the plot. He was kind of loosely tied in with the plot. And then there's other lines that are lifted directly from these things called scaffold speeches of the gunpowder conspirators. When somebody was executed in Elizabethan and Jacobean England, there was an opportunity for them to give these speeches before they died, which kind of served as confession in a non-Catholic England.
Sure.
Yeah. And also allowed them to confess what they had done and appeal to the king for mercy for the family that they left behind, so that their property wouldn't disappear, their family wouldn't be left destitute just because they committed treason, for example. And there's certain elements of things that Macbeth says and the equivocator that are just pulled directly out of there. Going back to that dunnest smoke of hell, though, this is like the coolest thing that I found while learning about references, is that the stage effects of the time used gunpowder a lot, the actual substance. And the story starts with thunder and lightning to bring in the witches at the top of the show. And the way that thunder was created in Shakespeare's time was likely a gunpowder bang. So the theaters would have actually smelled of gunpowder when the audience, you know, was starting to watch the play. And when Lady M is talking about Pauly and the dunnest smoke of hell, it's been less than a half an hour, maybe, since. And that smell lingers, especially in when this was performed at Hampton Court indoors. That smell would have been still lingering and awful.
Oh, that's so crazy.
So it's this very present, like, this horrible thing almost happened, and now we're going to make it omnipresent in your nose.
Well, and that's funny because you also mentioned, wasn't King James particularly lauded for his sense of smell?
Yes.
That's the other thing that Elise brought to that, and I was like, that's so funny. It's so funny to me.
And Duncan is like really bad at smelling out yeah, there's traitors. This whole traitors, recognizing who is a traitor amongst his midst. And then when he's walking into Dunsinane for the first time, he says, this air hath a pleasant seat. It's, you know, great to our senses, very amenable. And the audience is sitting there like, it smells like gunpowder in right. here. It's gross. And gunpowder does not smell good.
No.
And yeah, James was said to have actually sniffed out the gunpowder plot.
That's so funny. Yeah. Right? I want it to be true. I really don't think it was, but I want it to be true.
No, it was a letter. There was the letter that was sent to Mont Eagle, and then there were some guards that did the rounds, and someone was like, hey, there's a dude in the basement. I wonder what he's doing. And they checked out what was happening down in the basement, and it was Guy Fawkes with all of the all the paraphernalia. So James didn't have anything to do with finding them. I believe he did torture Guy Fawkes and interrogate him once Guy Fawkes was found, but this is just giving James some sense of credibility that doesn't exist historically.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of James torturing and interrogating people, he was obsessed with witches, so that ties into Macbeth as well, obviously. So tell me about his book Demonology.
It's a weird one.
Yeah,
nothing.
Yeah. So what we know is that James was a strong believer in the supernatural and the power of magic. But unlike some of the popular thought of the time, he didn't believe there was light or natural magic. And he was a very academic man, and he made an extensive study of the subjects of magic, witchcraft, and demons. And this was an effort for him to know his supernatural enemies. And when he married Princess Anne of Denmark, that trip bringing her over to Scotland had a lot of trouble with storms and other things like that. And rumors started that witches were involved in sabotaging his marriage to Princess Anne, who became Queen Anne. And he actually was very terrified for his life and started interrogating the women who started becoming accused of witchcraft, these alleged witches. And through that interrogation, as well as his theological studies that he did in his free time, he wrote a book as if he was the expert of witchcraft and magic. And he also wrote about how to deal with witches and magicians. And so that's really what demonology is it's this conversation about what is magic, how do you find it, and then what do you do to punish those who practice witchcraft?
Yeah. And then the witches in Macbeth, how do they sort of resemble the witches that are described in demonology?
The way that they use their magic comes directly from his accounts in demonology. So
yeah,
the use of body parts for spells and the double toil and trouble scene, that in one of their early scenes, they, you know, talk about controlling the weather. I'll give thee a wind, thou art kind.
Right.
They're vengeful. They can fly through the air. They have familiars, come Grey Malkin, Paddock calls, right? And they also talk about, you know, some equivocation. All of these come basically straight from the book that James wrote.
Mm-hmm. Right. And they also, James says that that witches can tell the truth part true, part false, right? Which sort of sounds a lot like what these witches do.
Right. Yeah. And a lot like what Banquo says about, you know, the instruments of darkness can tell us, you know, truths, win us with truths to betray us with false trifles, something like that. Like, very similar concept of, you know, they may tell us truths to begin with and then tell us lies to trick us, like, in order to trick us.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty creepy. That's very interesting. So Shakespeare, would he have had access to James's book then? Like, would that have been something that he could have been reading as part of this? Or was it, you know, kind of common knowledge at the time what you would look for in a witch?
I think he would have had access to it. The first book of demonology, I think, was published in 1593. And then when James was crowned king, there was another edition that was published. And I don't remember if there's a divide between Scotland and England between those two publications. But I do know that it was published shortly after the North Berwick witch trials. And then once he was king, it was republished. And he very well could have had access to that to read exactly what James was talking about and like pick pieces he liked.
Yeah. And how much were witch trials kind of a thing that was going on then?
In Scotland, during the North Berwick witch trials, which is before James is king of England, right? Huge.
Yeah.
Going on like kind of all throughout Scotland. North Berwick is just this big one that was actually, because the king was involved, there were records kept of who was interrogated, what they confessed to, what they were accused of, what they were caught doing, and the judicial, and that's in air quotes, process these mostly women were put through.
Yeah.
And then, but it died out shortly after. There was kind of a big trend of witch trials that died before he became king of England.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
His fascination didn't end. He was just...
clearly. And you also mentioned in your podcast one reason why James said that it was mostly women who were being possessed by the devil to do this and agreeing, you know, making agreements with the devil to do this. Why was that?
Yeah. A lot of demonology stems from the scriptures. So he has many references to stories in the Bible, and the story of Eve and the serpent that inspired his ratio. I don't know where the number 20 to 1 came from. That was the ratio. 20 to 1, 20 women to one man conspire with the devil. And that's because of Eve and original sin. So I wish I knew how he pulled this number.
Yeah. He also makes a difference, too, between women who are witches and men who are
magicians and sorcerers.
Magicians and sorcerers.
Right.
So, and it's the difference between being educated and not. The fact that women are uneducated makes them more susceptible, because men can, like him, study magic as much as they want but not practice it. And because women aren't educated enough to, you know, study it for purely scholarly purposes and to be able to recognize it, they don't recognize when the devil comes to trick them.
Yeah.
James's words, not mine, obviously.
Of course. Sounds like he's just giving himself license to study it.
Well, exactly.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. And he actually mentions in, well, him, he is represented in the Book of Demonology through this character Epistemon, and he's the expert of all things demonology. And there's a moment where he says something like, oh, and I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but he says something like, oh, you know, I could go more into this, but I don't want to actually teach anyone how to actually do this magic. So he had license to learn it himself and understand what magic was, and but he didn't want to teach anyone about it. It was like just for him, so that he could better crack down on the witch problem that was happening in Scotland at the time.
Yeah, that's another thing. Tell me about the structure of the book. It's this kind of strange Greek dialogue type of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very hard to read. I started out very optimistic, and then it was like banging up my head on the wall, because it gets to you. But
it's so dry.
It's very dry.
Yeah.
And the book is in three parts, and it starts out, it's a conversation between two characters, Epistemon and Philomathes. And Epistemon is James, basically, this guy who knows everything. And Philomathes is a skeptic who isn't convinced that magic is a bad thing. And Epistemon's goal in this conversation is to convince him that there's a problem and we need to eradicate witches. And book one, like Elise said, with talking about the difference between sorcerers and witches, book one divides those branches of magic and differentiates between them, the magicians and necromancers and sorcerers and witches. And then book two discusses how witches are controlled by the devil. And then mm-hmm. book three talks about the four types of spirits that exist. And then it concludes that witches must be put to death and gives the reader this energy to go out and rid Scotland of the witch problem. So, yeah.
That's so interesting, especially because in Macbeth, it doesn't really seem like the witches are the problem. Like, this isn't like, oh, those witches, they're out there, we're going to go take them down. Mm-hmm. They're sort of treated as harbingers of truth in a way. And is Shakespeare putting the blame on Macbeth for listening to them? Like, is he trying to say, oh, hey, James, you're right. This is what happens if people listen to witches.
Possibly. Yeah. Yeah. I think if, like, we look at it as what would James take, like, now today, right, we definitely see this anti-hero of Macbeth, this person who could have been a great king, but, you know, was led astray either through his own ambition or by listening to the supernatural. And there's a lot of discussions in productions I've been in about, are they fate or are they, you know, just some people who managed to interfere with the politics of Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's possible that, like, with James's point of view of these being, you know, magical beings who work for the devil, it's very possible that, like, because this is a warning that this is what happens when someone, you know, listens to witches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, because they'll tell you things that are part true, part false.
Right.
Look where it gets you. Yeah, yeah, exactly. That makes a lot of sense. And then speaking about Scottish politics and Scottish history, a lot of where Shakespeare took his inspiration for this story is from Holinshed's Chronicles. Can you tell me about what that is?
Holinshed's Chronicles is a historiography of England, Scotland, and Ireland, and it was wildly popular at the time. When Shakespeare was writing Macbeth, he would have been reading from the second edition, the second publication, and it sets up the history of the British Isles, the UK, from, I believe it starts off with the Isles of Britain, and then as far as kings go, it starts, I want to say, William the Conqueror, and it sets out each regent year, and it's a giant historiography that had been edited by a bunch of different people who came from different parts of this UK area. So you had some Protestants, Catholics, people who were Scottish, who were English, who were Irish, and that's what Holinshed's Chronicles is. It's basically, it may or may not be accurate, so I definitely suggest if you look at it, take it with a grain of salt.
Right.
Yeah, it's like, it's part history. Yeah, part history, part, you know, Arthurian legend almost. Like, who knows what's 100% real.
Right. Yeah. And then, so parts of James's lineage can be traced back to the people that we see in Holinshed's Chronicles, right? And then some of them show up in Macbeth a little bit.
Right. So we can actually find the characters of Duncan and Banquo, Macbeth and his wife, Gruach.
Oh, she gets a name.
Yeah, what a name, too. In Holinshed's Chronicles. And the answer about that baby, that Macbeth has a stepson named Lulach, who's Gruach's son from her first marriage, who also becomes king.
Oh, wow. So that's the baby that Lady Macbeth mentions.
So that's the baby. Right. Yeah. So that's the baby.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But so we see all of those in Holinshed's. And we also see the murder of Duncan by Macbeth in Holinshed is depicted in Holinshed's. And I mean, at the time, also, like, it's not an aberration. It's that, like, these kings are killing each other. It's just like, and so-and-so killed so-and-so to and
right.
And then later, so-and-so killed so-and-so. Duncan murdered Gruach's father, I want to say.
Oh, wow.
You know, so it that's just Scotland during this time.
Yeah.
Right. That gives her a little more motivation.
Yeah. Right. Also interesting about the I couldn't kill him because he resembled my father when he slept line.
Oh.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's so fascinating.
To think about, like, are we trying to make a reference to that? Who knows?
Yeah.
Could it be an interesting choice? But yes, James I believed he was descended from Banquo and Duncan. He claimed right to the, this is going to get a little bit weedsy, so I'm going to try and sum it up as much as I can. But his claim to the Scottish throne basically lies with this king, Fergus I, who was the first king of Scotland. In that line, James was the 108th king. Malcolm was the 86th, and Duncan was the 84th, and that, like, lineal parent-to-child reign of kings, basically.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then, while Banquo and Fleance were never kings, their line became the Stuart line. Fleance's descendant in the seventh degree, so great-great-great-great-great-great grandchild was married to the daughter of King number 99 in the Fergus line, and his son became the first Stuart king. And then James was another 8 generations, if you skip Mary Queen of Scots, from that king. So when you're thinking about the line of 8 kings with the Banquo apparition, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, you could say, like, either James is, you know, in that mirror that the last king is holding up, because it's reflecting, you know, maybe it's that 7 from or it would be 8 from Banquo, right, if we include Fleance. Right. And then we see a reflection of at least eight more in the mirror, which would end with James.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's fascinating.
What a, like, strange reference to make for, like, yeah. art, but, like, it's to me, it's super interesting because it's like, oh, that didn't just come out of nowhere. There's a very specific reason why it's 8 kings that follow Banquo, and Banquo looks back at them and smiles.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Well, it's fascinating because I feel like Macbeth is so rarely studied as a sort of history play. You know, it's mostly about the psychological, but yeah, I would never have connected a lot of those things if you guys hadn't, you know, done the research there and I hadn't listened to it. Well, so.
And Elise and I have talked about that before, where it's like, why is this not labeled a history? And the only thing we've really been able to come up with is because it's Scottish history, not English history, but it's history. It's a part of the Chronicles, and it's a twisting of history because Macbeth was not this tyrannical ruler over the course of, you know, however long the play takes place. He reigned for, I think, 14 years or something like that. And so that part is very twisted, but it is history. It's history very much in the same way of the Henriads. So...
Yeah,
I don't know.
That's fascinating. And did your average English person, you know, a groundling or whatever, would they have been able to make these connections? Would they have thought of it as a history play?
I don't know. I mean, I know that there was a lot of animosity or prejudice towards the Scots from English subjects. So I know that they had opinions of Scottish people, but I don't know if they would have been tuned into what the history of Scotland was like, especially if they weren't able to read the Chronicles.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think it would have to depend on the person who's seeing this play, right?
Sure.
Because when we talk about the Chronicles, it sounds like this dusty book to us. And but in the late 1500s, early 1600s, that's like the main form of pop culture. And I think that, you know, maybe they didn't get the, you know, Holinshed Chronicles stuff that is kind of in there for maybe more of the courtiers in James's court and James himself. But they definitely would have caught on to the gunpowder plot stuff because those pamphlets were circled so widely. That was like Twitter of
yeah,
like the... early 1600s.
Yeah, 16, yeah. And the executions were a public event. So people would have been going to watch them be executed. So talk would have been going around the town that it was, there was this plot.
It was reality TV of the time. Right. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and then James also wrote a pamphlet about witchcraft, right? News from Scotland.
Oh, yeah. I don't remember the author of the pamphlet, but he definitely contributed to the pamphlet.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that.
And that would have been basically a retelling of what happened during the North Berwick witch trials, who was accused, what they did, what happened to them after the trials. So that was, you know, I guess Elise has made references to certain things being the true crime documentary. I would place this also in like an Elizabethan or Jacobean true crime drama as well. You know, who did what, how did it go down? And that's what that was. That was
maybe Macbeth is like a ripped from the headlines Law and Order.
There
we go.
For its contemporary audience, you know, there's there's all this stuff that it's covering, but it's not exactly what happened. But you can be like, oh, I know this case. I know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then again, the news from Scotland was also not accurate in a certain sense because it was James's retelling of what had happened during all of these interrogations. So
yeah, no, that makes sense. It's fascinating seeing all of this come together in this play that we all know so well, but we don't really think about in a like real life political sense. So it's super interesting. And you've described this play in your podcast as a treat for James. So you think that Shakespeare was writing this sort of, it almost feels like it was as a horror movie, like for James, like, oh, he's going to be really scared by all of this. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I also wanted to ask the ghosts and the other supernatural elements in the play. Do they discuss ghosts in demonology? I can't remember.
Yeah, they do. That's in book three. They talk about ghosts. So there are, four different types of spirits that demonology talks about. And there's the spirits that haunt, the spirits that follow and trouble individuals, the spirits that possess, and there's fairies. I don't know if fairies is a part of that, but those are the four types of spirits. And so, James does talk about that. And James actually was supposed to be knowledgeable of exorcisms because he had watched exorcisms take place before he wrote this book. So that was something that he was also fascinated by as well, was demonic possession.
Yeah, so we have the witches, we have all the ghosts and the apparitions. We have, I mean, it starts with the thunder and lightning and this sort of, you know, like he got caught in a storm constantly trying to get his wife. So yeah, am I missing anything in terms of, and then obviously all of the treason. Am I missing anything in terms of things that really would have appealed to James there?
There are some other things in this play that would have been a treat for James. One of them was the royal healing, which was the royal touch. So that's something that Duncan is said to possess. And it's referenced a few times. So that was like, if somebody is sick, the monarch can touch you and then you'll be healed. And James believed that he had that. Go ahead, Elise.
Yeah. When Malcolm goes to England, he's staying at the court of King Edward the Seventh, sixth or seventh. Who also had this ability. So, and they like talk, it's very short, but they like briefly reference that, like, you know, he's gonna go see the king do this thing after he meets with Macduff one of the times. So we have a scene between them.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. And speaking of Macduff, I think Macduff is also inserted in there for James because he's this Christ-like figure. His entrance is through the South Gate, which in the English history of drama, there's this medieval play structure called the pageant plays, which were mm-hmm. basically Bible stories that were performed. And they were, they had certain tropes and things that always happened in them. So the person who in one of the plays is knocking at the South Gate is Jesus Christ. So Macduff's entrance into Dunsinane to wake up the king, also his first entrance and the first time we've ever heard of him, he's knocking at the South Gate and enters through there. So he's set up to, I think that's also something James, who saw himself as a sort of God person on earth mm-hmm. through the divine right of kings mm-hmm. and being the head of the church, and would have, and being a devout Protestant, would have recognized and would have kind of seen himself in.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to ask if there was a character that you feel like was a sort of James self-insert.
Yeah, I would say James. I agree with that. In addition to what Elise was saying, what you see in demonology and his study of witchcraft and his insertion of himself in the North Berwick witch trials is that James was obsessed with this idea that he was a white knight on a quest for God. He saw himself as somebody who was fighting the fight for God against the devil. And if Macduff is this Christ-like figure, that's something that James would be able to potentially relate to.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one who, you know, defeats the person who listened to the witches / the devil and restores the rightful heir to the throne of Scotland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that sort of reaffirms James's claim to the throne there. So right? mm-hmm. pretty good way to end a play if your king is watching it.
And there's something that, relating it back to demonologies, one of the women that was accused of witchcraft who supplied James with most of the information that he used to write his book, Agnes Sampson. And Agnes Sampson told James that Satan told her, quote, "By reason, the king is the greatest enemy he hath in the world." And that cast James as a Christian knight in his eyes. Agnes kind of placed into this devil versus Christ figure for James, and he carried that a lot with him. So he was given information from this woman that he's in a fight against the devil himself. Yeah.
Wow. Oh, that's so cool. Mm-hmm. Well, then I think we're close to running out of time here, but is there anything else that you guys wanted to make sure that we got in here, or should we just send folks over to your podcast to hear all of the details?
I have one thing that I think that I reread some of my notes from demonology, and it dawned on me the severity that James's witchcraft statute had on Western society. And the Salem witch trials were carried out under James's statute. So when we think about the witch trials that were going on in England under James's reign, as well as what happened in Salem, the American version, they're linked, which I thought about that. And I was like, oh, gosh, that's terrifying that James had this legacy.
It's insane to remember that there's not that much time between those.
Mm-mm. Yeah, that's the only thing that I revisited. And I was like, oh, my goodness, like this history that happened in England does permeate into what we as Americans see with our witchcraft trials.
Right.
And I was like, exactly. Oh, thanks, James. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. You really helped us out so much. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you guys so much. And if anybody listening wants to continue hearing even more about King James and demonology and witchcraft and Macbeth, you can head on over to their podcast, Shakespeare Anyone, which will be linked in the description. And you guys are doing Twelfth Night next, right?
Right. Yes, we are. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask, if do you have any idea of the sort of topics that you'll be covering with Twelfth Night? If you want to leave it for us to find out, that's okay too.
I don't mind teasing some of the things that we're talking about. Do you mind, Elise?
No, I don't either. We'll have just released our episode on about Twelfth Night and plays for the court.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh,
so what was theater like when it wasn't produced in a theater in Shakespeare's mm-hmm. time because, mm-hmm. like Macbeth, Twelfth Night is one of the plays we know was performed in front of nobility mm-hmm. in a castle, yeah. in like a castle.
Yep.
Yeah.
So what does that mean?
Yeah. And I'm in the editing so cool. process, and it is juicy. You wouldn't think so, but ooh. It's a juicy episode.
I am so excited to listen. Mm-hmm. Thank you guys for providing so many hours of entertainment and knowledge. And thank you so much for being on here.
Thank you for having us,
thank
Emily.
Thank you, Emily. Thanks. Have a good one.
You too. Bye bye.
Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of Scurvy Companions, the No Sweat Shakespeare podcast. If you're interested in learning more, check out our site at nosweatshakespeare.com and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We look forward to talking Shakespeare with you again soon.